India and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. They realized all over the world where a dark man was being oppressed, he was being oppressed by the white man. Where the dark man was being exploited, he was being exploited by the white man. So they got together on a night and they had a common enemy. And when you and I here in Detroit, in Michigan, and in America, who have been awakened today, look around us. We realize here in America, we all have a common enemy.
There comes
whether
a time
he's in Georgia or Michigan, whether he's in California or New York, he's the same name.
When the world
blue eyes and blonde hair,
same
name.
They'll keep in time. Oh, when it's time to mend the hands of life, the greatest gift of all. We all a part of God's great big family.
We have to
and you know love is all we need.
Tonight, this is Cross Over Ancestors tonight. I'm glad to have you to come in to talk to us tonight. And we're talking about Black Revolution and Revolution. And what's going on over in Israel is nothing but revolution. It's nothing but mass murder. And it's not a war. Don't be brainwashed. People tell you it's a war. When it's a war, two people fighting. But ain't nobody fighting but the Jews that's shooting and killing little babies, little innocent babies. I'm concerned through the spirit of Dr. King, Malcolm X, through the spirit of our ancestors, that we have lost something to understand the realization of what's going on in the world. When you kill 7, 8 little bitty babies in incubators and you lie on your TV and your radio that it's normal, you bombing, killing little babies, and the government, I'm talking about the Democrat and Republican, want to send money over there. They want to send money to the family. What about the citizens, you and me in Chicago? Those that fought in Vietnam and Korea, those that died, our ancestors that died fighting to make this country safe. And we got people now saying, let's send some money. And we got people coming over, flooding over from Mexico, flooding the city. And it seemed like the leadership of America turned their back on the citizen that taxpayers that pay money. I want to get ready tonight to talk about the Black Revolution, but I want to talk about the white magic that's going on, that's happening right before our eyes. It's not about Thanksgiving, not about Christmas, not about Easter. It's about a people that has turned its back on black folks. It's about a people that have turned its back on the red man, the black man, the brown man, and have moved to another level. It's important on this night to talk about, and I want to say a little bit about this, every telephone, every call, every letter, every expression is an expression of love and joy. This is causing old ancestors, I say, our ancestors that gone on, and our ancestors, I could call their name, but there's so many have been murdered, so many have been killed, and we have locked and chained and brought us over here to America. And we are the product of our ancestors. I want to talk about, this is my house. And it's my house, is God's house. And in this house is love, joy, and peace. In this house is the power of God controlling things. Yes, look around. So this is my house. This is my land. The blood was spilled of your mother, your great-grandmother. Look at your family that buried. If it's buried in Arkansas, buried in Mississippi, buried in Tennessee, Louisiana, buried in Alabama, it still is our house. And it's the house that God have gave us. So if it's my house, it's God's house. If it's God's house, it means that your soul belongs to God. Body, mind, soul, and spirit belongs to God. You got to get out of jealousy, and we got to get out of that lazy mentality, that white magic, say, well, I can't do it. Come to young lazy. Well, I've got too old now, bitch. I'm 80. I'm 90. I can't do nothing. It's because you got to understand where we come from. We come from a proud people, and we come from a people that is proud, and we come from a people that is blessed. So this is my house, and if it's my house, it's God's house. I'm talking about Alabama, Mississippi. I'm talking about the world. We're getting ready to go into a world war. Stop the killing, save the babies. I'm still saying, stop the killing, save the babies. You need to read Psalms 19. You need to read Psalms 119. You need to get ready to say, this is my house. This is the house that God has given me to be able to go to the next level. I'm praying for you and you, and I want you to know all is well. Some of you crossed up and messed up, and you're going to stay that way because you won't take a stand and control your environment. You blame the white man. You blame mama didn't have, daddy didn't have. And I had a group of people I put to come and see. Half of the mama passed. Half the kids, well, she don't want us to have no funeral to say nothing about her. When this woman washed and cleaned, this woman took care of them. And this same woman brought people and packed House of Prayer Church. But her children is gone astray. Boy, it burns me up. I said that they are hellish. We can't, she don't, what she don't, it ain't what she want. It's what she did to help the community. I just thought I want to say that. God bless you, Sister Lena May, going into your birthday month. God bless you. And I want to, Reverend Dunlap and Mark Clark and Fred Hampton was December 4th. They was murdered here in Chicago by the police department and by the State Department. Mark Clark and Fred Hampton, they were Black Panther Party. They was murdered in their sleep. So it's still black people being murdered. It's black people still trying to fault somebody. But I want to say to you tonight, it's my house. If it's my house, it's God's house. If it's God's house, it's your house. You can sit back and make all kind of excuses why you can't do nothing. You're going to die doing nothing. I'm too old. I ain't got the resources. You have not because you asked not. What have you asked God to give you? Body, mind, soul, and spirit. I'm praying for you, Sister Cook, that had called me earlier. And I'm praying for you, Sister Deborah Ann. I haven't heard from you. And I want to tell you, all is well. Give me a call. I got a special message for those that call me. But you got to call me personally. Let me give you my number because you're lying. I ain't got the number, Bishop. The number is 708-582-0372. When you called me, I got a message for you. As we were in Maryville, Indiana today, praying for people, and as we get ready to go down south, and I'm praying for you, Sister Nett, I'm praying for you, Sister Peaches, I'm praying for you all as well. Some of you making great strides in spite of what's going on. But I want to talk about this is my house. And if your house, if your temple belongs to God, it's God's house, so it's your house. You should be able to command what you want God to do. Stop drinking, stop smoking, stop dope, all of that. A young lady called me and said her brother died, OD. Another lady called me from Alabama, said her cousin died, OD. Because you're not cleaning your temple up. Your temple is all confused and crossed up, and you won't stand up to say, this is my house, because this is God's house, and I want the best. And the best in December, January, and February coming to you. You have not because you ask not. Get ready for God to do something special for you, and get ready for the door that God will open up for you. And he'll open that door up special for you. So I want you to get ready and claim what God got for you and claim the breakthrough God's going to do for you, body, mind, soul, and spirit. And I want to share that with you tonight that God is able to take you to the next level. What level is that? God's going to take you to the level where you'll be a better man, a better woman. I'm going to take you to the next level where God will open up that door for you. And you say, well, Bishop, what'd it take? God has already made reservations for you. And you got to know how to master them reservations and know what God got for you. And God got something special for you. But you seem like you can't maintain what God got for you. And I want to tell you, God got something special. And what God got for you, man can't take it. And what God got for you, it belongs to you. And I just want people to know that God got something special. And what God got for you, can't nobody take it or steal it. So you get ready for God to bless you in a special way. And somebody said, this is what I need to do. You don't need to do nothing but just acknowledge the power of God and how God's going to bless you and open up a door for you where things are going to work in your behalf. And when it works in your behalf, it's going to work for you. And can't nobody take what God got for you. So if you let somebody take it, it means that you're not on the case what you're supposed to be on. Body, mind, soul, and spirit, I say to our ancestors, wherever they might be, I want to say, I say to them tonight, and all that stuff that's been hurting, God's going to turn around and turn it back. And we're talking about revolution time. It's time for the truth to come out. preachers don't want to tell the truth. The politicians don't want to tell the truth. So we live in a society of lies. And if you don't understand that, you all messed up yourself. Because you're supposed to be living better than you're living. Your lifestyle supposed to be much better. And if your lifestyle ain't much better, something is wrong with your lifestyle. Because your lifestyle supposed to be much better. Okay? If your lifestyle supposed to be much better, that means somebody done blocked you going to the next level. So I'm praying for you to go to the next level. And that next level gonna open the door for you. And you got to get ready, body, mind, soul, and spirit, and get ready and claim what God got for you. And if God got something special for you, the truth will come out. I'm gonna play a little bit of Malcolm X, and maybe you need to hear him.
Then you can start plotting a course that will make you appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. What you and I need to do is learn to forget our differences. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you're a Baptist, and you don't catch hell because you're a Methodist. You don't catch hell because you're a Methodist or a Baptist. You don't catch hell because you're a Democrat or a Republican. You don't catch hell because you're a Mason or an Elk. And you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you was an American, you wouldn't catch no hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell, all of us catch hell for the same reason. So we are all black people, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, ex-slaves. You are nothing but an ex-slave. You don't like to be told that. But what else are you? You are ex-slave. You didn't come here on the Mayflower. You came here in a slave ship, in chains, like a horse or a cow or a chicken. And you were brought here by the people who came here on the Mayflower. You were brought here by the so-called pilgrims or founding fathers. They were the ones who brought you here. We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter, and a common discriminator. So once we all realize that we have this common enemy, then we unite on the basis of what we have in common. And what we have foremost in common is that enemy, the white man. He's an enemy to all of us. I know some of you all think that some of them are enemies. Time will tell. In Bandung, back in, I think, 1954, was the first unity meeting in centuries of black people. And once you study what happened at the Bandung Conference and the results of the Bandung Conference, it actually serves as a model for the same procedure you and I can use to get our problems solved. At Bandung, all the nations came together. They were dark nations from Africa and Asia. Some of them were Buddhists. Some of them were Muslim. Some of them were Christian. Some of them were Confucianists. Some were atheists. Despite their religious differences, they came together. Some were communists. Some were socialists. Some were capitalists. Despite their economic and political differences, they came together. All of them were black, brown, red, or yellow. The number one thing that was not allowed to attend the Bandung Conference was the white man. He couldn't come. Once they excluded the white man, they found that they could get together. Once they kept him out, everybody else fell right in and fell in line. This is the thing that you and I have to understand. And these people who came together didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have jet planes. They didn't have all of the heavy armaments that the white man had, but they had unity. They were able to submerge their little petty differences and agree on one thing, that though one African came from Kenya and was being colonized by the Englishmen, and another African came from the Congo and was being colonized by the Belgians, and another African came from Guinea and was being colonized by the French, and another came from Angola and was being colonized by the Portuguese. When they came to the Bandung Conference, they looked at the Portuguese and at the Frenchmen and at the Englishmen and at the other Dutchmen and learned or realized that the one thing that all of them had in common, they were all from Europe. They were all European, blonde, blue-eyed, and white-skinned. They began to recognize who their enemy was. The same man that was colonizing our people in Kenya was colonizing our people in the Congo. The same one in the Congo was colonizing our people in South Africa and in southern Rhodesia and in Burma and in India and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. They realized all over the world where a dark man was being oppressed, he was being oppressed by the white man. Where the dark man was being exploited, he was being exploited by the white man. So they got together under this basis that they had a common enemy. And when you and I here in Detroit and in Michigan and in America, who have been awakened today, look around us, we too realize here in America, we all have a common enemy. Whether he's in Georgia or Michigan, whether he's in California or New York, he's the same man. Blue eyes and blonde hair and pale skin. Same man. So what we have to do is what they did. They agreed to stop quarreling among themselves. Any little spat that they had, they'd settle it among themselves. Go into a huddle. Don't let the enemy know that you got a disagreement. Instead of us airing our differences in public, we have to realize we're all the same family. And when you have a family squabble, you don't get out on the sidewalk. If you do, everybody calls you uncouth, unrefined, uncivilized, savage. If you don't make it at home, you settle it at home. You get in the closet, argue it out behind closed doors. And then when you come out on the street, you pull a common front, a united front. And this is what we need to do in the community and in the city and in the state. We need to stop airing our differences in front of the white man. Put the white man out of our meeting, number one, and then sit down and talk shop with each other. I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution. There's a difference. Are they both the same? And if they're not, what is the difference? What is the difference between a Black Revolution and a Negro Revolution? First, what is a revolution? Sometimes I'm inclined to believe that many of our people are using this word revolution loosely, without taking careful consideration what this word actually means and what its historic characteristics are. When you study the historic nature of revolution, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal, and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed.
Yes. Right.
Number one, it was based on land. The basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The French Revolution What was it based on? The land left against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost. Was no compromise. Was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what a revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. Come on, man. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The land left against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. As long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite. And you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How you gonna be nonviolent in Mississippi as violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered? And at the same time, you're going to get violent with Hitler and JoJo and somebody else that you don't even know. If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it's wrong to be violent, defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it's wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in defense of her. The Chinese Revolution. They wanted land. They threw the British out, along with the Uncle Tom Chinese. Yeah, they did. They set a good example. When I was in prison, I read an article, and don't be shocked when I say I was in prison. You're still in prison. That's what America means, prison. When I was in prison, I read an article in Life magazine showing little Chinese girl, 9 years old, her father was on his hands and knees, and she was pulling the trigger because he was an Uncle Tom Chinaman. When they had the revolution over there, they took a whole generation of Uncle Toms, just wiped them out. And within 10 years, that little girl became a full-grown woman. No more Toms in China. And today is one of the toughest, roughest, most feared countries on this earth by the white man because there are no Uncle Toms over there. Of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward all research. And when you see that you got problems, all you have to do is examine the historic method used all over the world by others who had problems similar to yours. And once you see how they got theirs straight, then you know how you can get yours straight. There's been a revolution, a black revolution, going on in Africa. In Kenya, the Mau Mau were revolutionaries. They were the ones who made the word Uhuru. They were the ones who brought it to the fore. The Mau Mau, they were revolutionaries. They believed in scorched earth. They knocked everything aside that got in their way. And their revolution also was based on land, the desire for land. In Algeria, the northern part of Africa, a revolution took place. The Algerians were revolutionaries. They wanted land. France offered to let them be integrated into France. They told them to France to hell with France. They wanted some land, not some France. And they engaged in a bloody battle. So I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you, you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn-the-other-cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution. Only kind of revolution that's nonviolent is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution based on loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution in which the goal is a desegregated lunch counter, a desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. The white man knows what a revolution is. He knows that the black revolution is worldwide in scope and in nature. The black revolution is sweeping Asia, sweeping Africa. It's rearing its head in Latin America. The Cuban Revolution, that's a revolution. They overturned the system. Revolution is in Asia. Revolution is in Africa. And the white man is screaming because he sees revolution in Latin America. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is? You don't know what a revolution is. If you did, you wouldn't use that word. A revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise. Revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way. And you sitting around here like a knot on these folks, no matter how much they hate me. No, you need a revolution. Who ever heard of a revolution where they lock arms, as Reverend Cleek was pointing out beautifully, singing, "We Shall Overcome." Just tell me, you don't do that in a revolution. You don't do any singing, you're too busy swinging.
From our hatred of things that.
To understand this, you have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro, back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food. Because he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." Right. That's how you could tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire,
put the blade out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, what's the matter, boss? We sick. He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, let's run away, let's escape, let's separate, the house Negro would look at you and say, man, you're crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this? That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, I'm the only Negro out here. I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You nothing but a house Negro. And if someone comes to you right now and says, let's separate, you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. What you mean, separate? From America? This good white man? When you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa.
Make articulate, perceptive, courageous, outspoken. Just a few of the adjectives that so inadequately describe Malcolm X. Few singular personalities have emerged on the national and international scene to so excite and stimulate interest in the plight of 22 million Afro-Americans in the USA. Controversial? Without a doubt. Not only speaking out the agonies of 22 million members of the black masses, but effectively voicing the guarded views and opinions of many of his detractors in the Negro elite. Indeed, Malcolm X speaks again is particularly timely as the spirit and status of this great human, even after physical death, continues to live and grow. We are privileged to again hear the voice of Minister Malcolm X.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome the opportunity to come into your home.
Sir, I would like to know what your position is on nonviolence.
Well, nonviolence is one of the things that has disarmed the so-called Negro here in America. And any Negro leader who teaches our people to be nonviolent in the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years is actually doing our people a disservice. In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime for any Negro leader to teach our people not to do something to protect ourselves, especially in the face of the violence that is inflicted upon us by the white people here in America. And whenever you teach a man to turn the other cheek or to be nonviolent, what you're actually doing is disarming the victim of white brutality. You're robbing him of his right to defend himself. In fact, the only time it's intelligent to be nonviolent is when you're dealing with someone else who's nonviolent. I'm nonviolent with those who are nonviolent with me. This is intelligent. But just as you see other people doing whatever is necessary to protect themselves, it's time today for the 22 million Afro-Americans to feel free to do whatever is necessary to protect ourselves. Take, for an example, in the Constitution, it gives a person the right to have a rifle or a shotgun. And in areas in this country where the government has proven itself either unwilling or unable to defend the black people, it is time for the black man to stand up and start defending himself, not to go out and initiate acts of aggression against whites or initiate acts of aggression against anyone. But in areas where we see that the government will not protect us or defend us or find those who have brutalized us and made us the victims for the past 400 years, then it is time for us to do whatever is necessary to defend ourselves. And it should be emphasized that by this I don't mean that we should go out and look for trouble or start trouble or initiate acts of aggression. But we should feel that we are within our human rights, our civil rights, and within the rights of intelligence to do whatever is necessary when we are attacked to defend ourselves. In fact, the best thing to teach our people is never to be the aggressor, never to look for trouble. But anytime anyone makes any effort to brutalize us or to inflict wounds upon us, we should feel that we are within our rights to do whatever is necessary to repel them. Do nothing unto anyone, but always do whatever is necessary to keep others from doing to you, which they've been doing for the past 400 years, making us the victims of brutality.
But it is not a fact, Minister, that people like Dr. Martin Luther King, who have advocated nonviolence, have been successful with their nonviolent moves?
Well, they've been successful in going to jail. They've been successful in becoming the victims of police dogs and police clubs and water hoses. If Dr. Martin Luther King feels that this is the best way to gain freedom, justice, and equality for our people in this country, well and good. I have no criticism of him whatsoever, but I think that the time has come now where the masses of black people feel that nonviolence shouldn't be taught to us unless it's also taught to the white people in this country, and black people shouldn't be taught to turn the other cheek unless the white people are taught to turn the other cheek. Now, if Dr. Martin Luther King can be so successful in disarming Negroes, they should send him to Russia and let him disarm the Russians, let him disarm some of these other countries where...
Malcolm, but I still have to take the stand that Dr. King has been a degree successful with the non-violent movement. Now, let's take the March on Washington, for instance. Was this not something that exemplified the feeling of the Negro and made everyone very, very happy?
It depends on whether or not anything was gotten out of it. In fact, yes, it probably made them happy. Most of the people I saw involved in the March on Washington looked very, very happy. In fact, they looked too happy to be involved in a Negro revolt. So that insofar as the March on Washington producing meaningful results, most of the masses of black people today and this year are beginning to see where nothing came of it other than the fact that it gave many of the bourgeois Negroes a chance to feel that they were doing something without really having to do anything. It became a status symbol. It's like going to the Kentucky Derby is a status symbol for those who know nothing about horses. They like to be able to say they went to the Kentucky Derby and they can't tell a horse from a cow. Or the Rose Bowl game. They like to be able to say they went to the Rose Bowl game and they don't know a football from a baseball. But the fact that they can say they went to the Rose Bowl game is a status symbol. Or the fact that they can say they went to the Kentucky Derby is a status symbol. So many Negroes took the opportunity to say that they were in the March on Washington. Not that it produced anything, or not that they really felt that they were involved in a Negro revolution, but it gave them a chance to say, I was there. It was a status symbol. But status symbols don't take us out of the alleys and out of the ghettos and out of the slums. Status symbols don't remove segregated school systems. Status symbols don't get meaningful civil rights legislation. So when it comes to the March on Washington and all of these other nonviolent approaches, they were good in their day, but this is a new day, and it's a new Negro.
But we will have to agree, Minister Malcolm, that the March on Washington was the forerunner to the creation of, or at least to the presenting of, the Civil Rights Bill. Without this type of approach, I doubt seriously that the Civil Rights Bill would have even been entered onto the floor.
A horse can enter into the race and come so far from the finish line that you don't even know that that horse was in the race. And since the March on Washington was designed to produce meaningful civil rights legislation, and if I recall, I heard several of the leaders of it point out that we'll be back if the bill meets with any kind of opposition come September. They said this in August. Now, September passed, and the bill, it didn't even come up. October passed, November passed, December passed, the year passed, everything passed, and the bill hasn't been passed yet.
Are you saying that you feel a more violent approach to it would cause this bill to be passed?
It's not a piece of violence. And I think that our people should never let themselves be trapped intellectually into thinking that whenever they do something to defend themselves against the violence of the white man, that they're being violent.
But you're advocating violence.
No, we're advocating the necessity of black people defending themselves against the violence of the white man, because the American government has already proven itself either
able or unwilling to defend us as it should do.
Well, the white man hasn't gone out to create any marches, nor has he gone out to do anything that would make the people in the community feel that he was opposed by law to their thinking.
No, all he has done is fix his police dolls on innocent black women and babies. All he has done is put his fire hoses on innocent women and children, black women and children.
That's right.
Or all he has done is shoot Medgar Evers in the back.
Right.
Or he has bombed the church in Birmingham, Alabama, and murdered four innocent little girls.
That's right.
Or he has shot down young boys from their bicycle as they were riding innocently through the street.
That's right.
That's all he has done.
Right.
Well, do you feel that this is a cause for the Negro to take on the violent act?
It's not a case of the Negro taking on a violent act, but it's a case of the Negro doing what is necessary to defend himself against the violent acts of the white.
Right.
Since the government has refused to defend the Negro.
Right.
The church was bombed and the government has done nothing about it.
Right.
Medgar Evers was murdered and the government has done nothing about it.
Right.
Emmett Till and Charles Max Potter were murdered and the government has done nothing about it.
Right.
But at the same time, the government is in South Vietnam, trying to tell them what to do. The government is in Berlin trying to tell them what to do. The government is in Africa trying to tell them what to do. But it cannot get its own people here in Mississippi and Alabama and New York City and tell them what to do.
Mr. Malcolm X discusses human or civil rights.
Minister Malcolm, I'd like to know why you place so much emphasis on calling the freedom struggle among Afro-Americans in this country a struggle for human rights rather than civil rights.
Well, most of our people don't even know the meaning of civil rights. And by not knowing what it is they're actually trying to get, it has eluded us for the past 100 years. Civil rights is supposed to mean citizenship. When you have civil rights, you have citizenship. When you have citizenship, you have civil rights. And if the 22 million Afro-Americans were actually citizens of this country, it wouldn't be necessary to pass any kind of additional legislation to include us in the Constitution. If you notice, whenever the people come here from Europe, they can come here from Poland, which is a communist country. They don't need any legislation to make this Polish person a citizen. They don't need any additional civil rights legislation to make the refugees from Hungary who come here citizens. They don't need any additional legislation to make anyone who comes to this country a citizen. But when it comes to the rights of the black people who are the descendants of slaves, then immediately new legislation is necessary. So this right here implies that when the Constitution was written, in some way or other, it must have excluded those of us who were slaves at that time. And because we were excluded from the Constitution when it was originally written, today they have to amend it in order to include us. But if you notice, the Civil War didn't include us in the Constitution. Had the Civil War included us in the Constitution, we would be citizens today. Had the amendments even to the Constitution actually included us, we would be citizens today. If the Supreme Court desegregation decision way back in 1954 was sufficient to include us into the jurisdiction of the Constitution, all of our problems would be solved today. So there's something about civil rights that makes it almost impossible for us to get it. So you have to know the difference between civil rights and human rights. As long as our people are begging for civil rights or they are labeling their struggle for freedom, justice, and equality under the label of civil rights, then what they do is leave us in the jurisdiction of Uncle Sam's court. And it's actually Uncle Sam who is guilty of all of the violation of our rights that have taken place in this country. So when you go to Uncle Sam to try and get some kind of redress over civil rights violations, you're taking your case to the man who's responsible for the violation. So the only way our people can really get some meaningful results, it has to be taken out of Uncle Sam's hands and taken into a world court. And the world court that has been set up to listen to the complaints of human rights violations is in the United Nations. Human rights are international, and civil rights come within the jurisdiction of the country where these rights are violated. Some people may wonder why our brothers from Africa and Asia have not spoken out more boldly or without compromise on the injustices that the 22 million Afro-Americans experience in this country. They can't speak out. As long as these injustices are labeled by us as civil rights, then this remains a domestic issue, and none of our people from abroad, because of protocol,
can become involved in Uncle Sam's domestic problems. So all the civil rights groups have to do is expand the struggle from civil rights to human rights. And once it is expanded to the level of human rights, then this puts us in a position to charge Uncle Sam with violating the UN Charter on Human Rights. We can take it before the United Nations, and other nations of this earth can then side with us and indict Uncle Sam for the mistreatment of 22 million Afro-Americans. The very fact that the struggle of the black people in South Africa, or I should say the injustices that have been experienced by black people in South Africa have come before the UN, or the injustices experienced by our own people again in Angola have been brought before the UN. Even the oppression of the Hungarians has been brought before the UN. The plight of the Jews in Soviet Russia, and there's only 3 million of them in Russia, have been brought before the UN. Well, then why hasn't the problem of the 22 million Afro-Americans come before the United Nations? It has not come before them because the leaders of the civil rights struggle don't understand what civil rights actually amount to. When they are mature to the point where they can see that their present struggle has kept them under Uncle Sam's jurisdiction and Uncle Sam is not morally capable of solving this problem, then they will shift this out of the courts of Uncle Sam and take it to the courts of the United Nations on the level of human rights, and we'll get some kind of meaningful result. As long as we keep it at the civil rights level, we alienate the support of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia. But when we shift it to the level of human rights, we have the support of billions of black, brown, red, and yellow people from all over this earth behind us.
The United States is a great world power and has in the past exercised a lot of control and power within the United Nations. So how can you expect to wage a successful battle against such a powerful country in a world court?
Well, whenever you believe in what the United States has taught us concerning democracy, which means one voice, one vote, this is good, because in the present world setup, world governmental setup, as is represented by the United Nations, each country there has one vote, which means that no matter how wealthy a nation is, it only has one vote. And no matter how poor a nation is, it still has one vote. So the ballot actually equalizes the poor man and the rich man. Back when the United Nations was set up, it consisted largely of white nations, because most of the dark nations were then colonized and weren't independent. Since the dark nations have gained their independence and have emerged on the scene, today in the UN you have more dark nations who are in a position to vote in a block than you have white nations. So that we have a situation now where the grouping together of the dark nations who formerly were colonized has given them enough political power to offset the military power and prestige of these mighty white nations of the West. And it is their support. It is only in the United Nations, where everyone has the ballot, where everyone has equal vote, that the plight of the black man can be given a just hearing and the weight of the dark world can become down on our side and balance the scales on our side. Whenever you take it into the white man's court, you never will get justice, because the white man is the guilty one who committed the crime in the first place. It's like taking your case from the wolf to the fox to take it to Washington, D.C.
I don't think I wholeheartedly go along with that, Mr. Malcolm. I have some appreciation for your discussion as regards to the human right and the civil right. But here in America, as a band of Negroes, I think the most progressive thinking that we could possibly attain is civil rights. This is the thing that we want. This is the thing that we hope to get. This is the thing that we're going out to fight for. Without our civil rights, the human rights, and the rest of the elements are non-entities as far as
human rights come before civil rights.
That may be so, but the civil rights are an important factor.
You can never get civil rights until you have human rights. Human rights represent the right to be a human being. Whenever you are respected and recognized as a human being, your civil rights are automatic.
But if we get civil rights, we are human beings.
No, you have to get the recognition of human rights first. This is why people can come here from Africa and Asia and immediately are able to benefit from what the Constitution stands for, because they are recognized as a human being when they touch the shores of North America. But the black people in this country, all of our human characteristics were destroyed by slavery. Our language was destroyed. Our history was destroyed. Our culture was destroyed. And then the white man taught us that we were savages in the jungle and living at a subhuman level. And for this reason, when they put the Constitution together, they classified our people as three-fifths of a man, which meant subhuman, not a complete human being. And once our human characteristics were completely destroyed, this gave them justification for
treating us like we were animals. And then, and it also justified they're selling us from plantation to plantation like you sell a horse and a cow and a bag of wheat. Why, George Washington himself, historically, is on record as having sold or having traded a black man for a keg of molasses, which shows you he didn't regard that black man as a human being. If the black man's human rights had been respected, he never could have been a slave here in America. And if his human rights had been restored by the Emancipation Proclamation, automatically we would have been citizens right after the Civil War. So we must be regarded as human. Our human rights must be respected before we can ever be regarded as citizens and our civil rights be respected.
Discourage us from attending white schools. But he does say that it is better for us to go to our own schools, and after we have a thorough knowledge of ourselves, of our own kind, and racial dignity has been instilled within us, then we can go to anyone's school, and we'll still retain our race pride, our racial dignity, and we will be able to avoid the subservient inferiority complex that most Negroes have or are, that is instilled within most Negroes receive this sort of integrated education.
Well, you have a private school operating here in Chicago, at least, and possibly elsewhere, and it's been a subject of controversy lately. What is the acceptance of people who come out of your private schools into schools of higher learning?
Yes, we have many students who have graduated from the University of Islam on 54th and Greenwood that are now,
who formerly were colonized, has given them enough political power to offset the military power and prestige of these mighty white nations of the West. And it is their support. It is only in the United Nations, where everyone has the ballot, where everyone has equal vote, that the plight of the black man can be given a just hearing and the weight of the dark world can come down on our side and balance the scales on our side. Whenever you take it into the white man's court, you never will get justice because the white man is the guilty one who committed the crime in the first place. It's like taking your case from the wolf to the fox.
What are they saying? Listen.
I charge the white man with being the greatest liar on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest drunkard on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest swine eater on earth. Yes, the Bible forbids it. I charge the white man with being the greatest gambler on earth. I charge the white man, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, with being the greatest murderer on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest peace breaker on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest adulterer on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest robber on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest deceiver on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest troublemaker on earth. So therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask you, bring back a verdict of guilty as charged.
The indictment you've just heard is being delivered over and over again in most of the major cities across the country. This charge comes at the climax of a morality play called The Trial. The plot, indeed the message of the play, is that the white man has been put on trial for his sins against the black man. He has been found guilty. The sentence is death.
Here in the WBAI studios are Bayard Rustin, Executive Secretary of the War Resisters League, and Malcolm X, Minister of Muhammad's Temple of Islam in New York. Both of you gentlemen are working in your own ways for the welfare of the American Negro. And the first thing I'd like to ask you is if you would describe the purposes of your individual organizations and tell us something about the philosophies inherent in them. Mr. X.
Yes, sir. Mr. Donald. And I'm happy to be here today to represent the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to your audience. And as you know, Mr. Muhammad is the spiritual head of the fastest growing group of Muslims in the Western Hemisphere. And he perhaps is probably the greatest drawing card among the so-called Negro masses. more so than any other so-called Negro leader today, in proof of which a year ago in Washington, D.C., he appeared at the Uline Arena and drew 10,000. And in New York at the St. Nicholas Arena, last year he drew 10,000. And this year, I think he drew another between 10,000 and 15,000. In Chicago, he drew 15,000. And I cite these things just to show you that as a man, no matter what people, whether they agree with him or disagree with him, they have to admit that the masses of the so-called Negroes are interested in hearing what he has to say. Probably in the past 2 years, he has become the America's most talked about and most written about black man. And even at the present time, I'd say he's one of the most controversial topic, namely because he's having such miraculous success in getting his program over among the so-called Negro masses. And if you ask me what it is, I can best tell you what it is by what he is credited with doing. The Time magazine last year, in an article about Mr. Muhammad, pointed out that he has successfully eliminated from among his followers the use of alcohol, which is one of the things that has destroyed our people here in America as a race. He has successfully eliminated dope addiction, profanity, excessive profanity, which actually stems from disrespect of self. He has successfully eliminated stealing and crime among his followers. He has, Time magazine also pointed out that he has, Mr. Muhammad has been successful in eliminating adultery and fornication and prostitution and making the black man respect his woman, something that has been characteristically absent among our men. And Time magazine also pointed out that among the Muslims who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, juvenile delinquency has been eliminated. And in the U.S. News and World Report, about a couple months later in 59, they pointed out that Mr. Muhammad was successful in making the so-called Negroes see the importance of an economic program that would, in fact, when you think of what Time magazine said, they were giving him credit for being probably one of the greatest moral reformers that has appeared among the so-called Negroes here in America yet. And when you tie in what the U.S. News and World Report magazine said concerning his success at getting the so-called Negroes to set up stores and factories and farms to feed ourselves, grow food.